Firehouse.com. Real issues, real answers, real firefighters. Firehouse.com brings you the leaders of the nation's fire, rescue, and EMS services, the top columnists and educators, and today's most important issues, headlines, and comments. Listen right on your desktop or download and listen on the go to Firehouse.com.
All right, welcome. This is Firehouse Live, coming to you from Firehouse 2010 in San Diego City. We're at the convention center, and today we're doing a podcast on strip mall firefighting, tactic strategies, and tactical considerations related to strip mall fires. We're very fortunate today to have with us on the podcast some of the outstanding people that are instructing here at Firehouse. We actually have a special guest, Jennifer McDowell from Riverside City Fire, is joining us, a longtime captain with Riverside City Fire, and she's going to be able to join us today and help us out with understanding some of the tactics and considerations that we need to be planning for on these strip malls. Also, we have Captain Chris Vaughn from Salinas Fire Department, also the training officer with the City of Salinas Fire Department. And he's got a great deal of experience and knowledge related to these tactics, specifically up in that area, dealing with high-density structures, barred windows, secured occupancies, and multiple hazards facing firefighters in these strip malls throughout the nation. Also, once again, welcome back, Wes Kitchell, Santa Rosa Fire, well over 30 years with Santa Rosa Fire Department, truck captain and expert in the field of fireground tactics and strategy. I'm Ed Hadfield, and we're looking forward to getting this podcast started. So I'll start it off and go from here. I want to open this up to the panel. Panel, we find as instructors, as training officers, as field personnel doing the job, that one of the more common fires that we deal with are the commercial strip malls. And they present some very unique hazards and challenges that we face. The strip mall fire has claimed lives before. As we all recall, the tragic video from years ago of Jim Howe from Los Angeles County Fire Department, and may he rest in peace. Losing his life as a result of a facade and fascia collapse. There's been other firefighters that have been caught in the same tragedy, so I want to come back and talk with that. But why don't we start off by opening it up to the group and talk about some of the challenges that they see facing young officers as it comes to dealing with these strip mall fires and some of the complexities and questions that they have in their mind. So I'll open that up to the group. Go ahead, Chris.
I'd say being a new officer, one of the challenges is just trying to systematically approach the building and not become overwhelmed with its length, and realizing that you know, there are four sides of access, and don't forget the rear of the building.
Okay. All right. I know that a lot of companies, a lot of organizations out there, Chris, one of their standard operating procedures, and we all understand that standard operating procedures are a guideline in dealing with these commercial tactics. They will assign a company to the rear of it at all times. They will sometimes require or at least request that a company provide a water supply to the rear. And oftentimes, based upon the design features of the strip mall itself, they'll assign the truck to the rear structure. And I'm looking at Wes right now, and he knows what I'm talking about. Wes, why don't we talk about some of the spotting, positioning, safety considerations that we need to consider for strip malls with the truck company?
Well, some of those are, it's dependent on the building and the age of the building. A lot of it is. Oftentimes, because of aesthetics and the like, you have a fascia that goes down the side and across the front that's not conducive to good ladder placement, not conducive to good access to the roof. So oftentimes you're spotting on the back of the building, hopefully at the uninvolved end, so that you have some real estate between you and the fire. The other part is you made a good point that oftentimes the back is really underestimated or not really acknowledged in the initial stages of this. And what comes to mind there is just being aware of the buildings in your jurisdiction and actually going out and looking at these buildings and not just driving by them on the way to some other task, but to get out, look at the building, especially the rear. The rear is where you're going to do your lion's share of the heavy work, is making sure that's open. And that's where you've got to make that secondary egress for the people that are inside, regardless of whether it's just the fire occupancy or the accessory or exposure occupancies on either side of that. That's a really big thing. And I think that comes back to one of the points Chris made, is not being overwhelmed. But you've got a number of things you got to think about. You've got to forecast into this thing a lot of factors of where is the fire now, where is it going to be from a truck company perspective, so that you can do good vertical ventilation, start thinking about defensive vertical ventilation, as well as how you're going to deploy your company to the rear. If you have one truck at scene to begin with, how are you going to split those resources to make it safe for the engine companies and still get up and try and do some vertical offensive ventilation to support the engine companies? Very, so I think that's a big part of it.
Very good. You know, it's I was actually visiting a good friend of ours, Chief Dan Orr from Santa Maria Fire, and they broke a strip mall fire, and that was one of his assignments. Was he once he got on scene, the truck was arriving, and they had him go to the rear for laddering, and supported them with an engine company, because his primary thought process was that, given that the potential of a facade fascia collapse would occur, that would inhibit any deployment into the front Alpha Division side of the structure to those resources, and that he wanted the rear not only opened up, but he wanted it supported with a water supply and hose lines and a working set. And we're going to talk about a working set in a little bit, but that was one of the key things, and I think that's very important for our listeners to understand, is that, you know, if we're addressing the attack from the Alpha Division and working through the fascia or facade, not working under the fascia or facade, then we have to give our interior companies a secondary means of egress, which will primarily be a heavily secured Charlie Division. And oftentimes, if those interior companies can work through the occupancy and create their own egress, that's exceptional. Mm-hmm. But if not, that needs to be supported by companies to the rear that have a water supply, hose lines down, and are supporting the roof division with those working sets. So hats off to Chief Orr. Another good point is one of my mentors, Gary Finney, from Huntington Beach Fire Department, used to say, boys, we're going to go walk alleys today, because you learn more walking alleys than you do walking the front of the structure, because the alleys where, as you said, that lion's share is going to be. Jennifer, you've been a captain for a pretty good time, and working in Riverside City is a busy organization. It's a good-sized, mid-sized organization in Southern California. What are some of the challenges you see facing your organization from a standpoint of fighting strip mall fires, which, you know, I know you guys have quite a few, and as a senior captain or a more senior captain, what are some of the challenges you see your younger officers facing in making good, sound, tactical, and strategic decisions?
Well, I'm finding that in the strip mall scenarios that training is huge. And by us being aggressive and getting out and training and doing the pre-planning on these businesses, we're learning that the smaller hose lines, the inch and three quarters, inch and a half hose lines, aren't enough. And so being that we don't have a lot of the strip mall fires, I think we need to start training in the mindset of using larger hose, larger water, you know, inch and a quarter, inch and an eighth tips, and you know, getting that fire out so that we're not causing the spread to the adjacent units. And then in addition to that is not getting so focused in on that unit that's actually on fire, but checking those side units to see if it's extended. Because as we well know, building construction, you know, the newer building construction, we have the potential for it to collapse and fail. And if we're not, you know, checking those adjacent units and stopping it, then we're just endangering ourselves. So as a company officer, you know, I would say that we need to get out and train more and go beyond just the basics, you know, so that we can see the whole picture.
Excellent. And I got to admit, you're talking my lingo. You start talking about inch and a quarter, inch and an eighth, and I get all excited, because the use of penetration and reach from a smoothbore application and the ability to get a consistent, constant flow at a lower engine pressure is going to be key in those. Because, as you said, oftentimes we're taking an offensive approach from a defensive position on the unit of involvement, where we're in what you said, and I'm going to paraphrase it, was that we can't get back what occurred an hour ago in that unit. I mean, we can't turn back the time. The damage is done in that unit. But what we can do is take care of our exposures through extension control. And the beauty to that is that we're really following that Rivas model. You know, we've identified that, you know, through identification of structural elements, we've got our rescue profile built into it by not putting people into an endangered occupancy, keeping them out from underneath the fascia or facade that may potentially collapse, utilizing the penetration and reach of smoothbore application and getting the higher fire flows, and yet addressing extension and exposure control on both sides of the occupancy, and stopping the rapidly advancing fire by recognizing that. I want to talk to Chris real quick, because Chris is recently come off the truck company and has a tremendous amount of knowledge related to ventilation operations. And Chris, there's a little bit of a tactical controversy out there, and we might as well broach it right now, is some people will say that on a large volume, common space, attic space, okay, with a large void in the fascia or facade itself, that by simply placing positive pressure blowers in the Bravo 1, Delta 1 exposure, that you can pressurize these units and keep the fire from spreading. And then there's the other approach. And don't get me wrong, you know, I think positive pressure is an excellent tool. But is it a standalone tool that we can count on in that situation? And if not, how can we utilize it effectively, coupled or blended with our vertical ventilation?
I think you hit the nail right on the head with the latter of your example. I think we shortchange ourselves and set ourselves up for potential, non-success with solely utilizing positive pressure. I mean, if we're not checking that void and aggressively getting on the roof and checking those the backside of those fascia, at least open them up and inspecting where the fire is spreading, if it's intact with, you know, firewalls or partitions. I'm a huge proponent of utilizing positive pressure with staffing the incident and putting people in kind of a forward position and trying to truly isolate where that fire is in those voids. And then at the same time, you know, maybe coordinate that with an aggressive topside ventilation effort. Then we're doing what we're supposed to do. We will pressurize the building, but at least we're giving it somewhere else to go in a more orchestrated, direct fashion versus just blowing it through the voids.
Mm-hmm. So, and I know, you know, at least in my experience, is that historically we have always relied upon roof division, the truck assigned to the roof, and we're going to talk the difference between roof division and ventilation group on these particular occupancies. We have always relied on roof division to not only rapidly access the roof itself and identify the structural type and identify that and provide that information to interior companies operating either in the attack unit or in the Bravo or Delta exposures, because a lot of times they don't have the ability to determine what type of truss or roof assembly is above them, so that if roof division can put a giant inspection hole in off the Alpha Delta corner and say, hey, you know what, you've got wooden I-beam truss 24 inches on center, you got open web bar joist truss 36 inches on center, that gives us an idea of what's working above us. Historically, we've always counted on not only that information, but we've also counted on roof division to open up the rear of the facade and fascia to determine extent of spread of fire and approach and extinguish the fire from that aspect. Now, I know that has been a very successful tool. We've utilized it in my career. I've done it. Wes, you were on the truck, well over 20 years. How did you guys find that as an approach?
You have to do it. because of fascia or facade, whatever you want to call it, that's just a tunnel for fire. It's not a structural piece of the building. So it from a hazard aspect, if it's well involved, you have the potential for that fascia to start coming off. So if you're putting people not necessarily under it, but even through it, it's just that whole timing thing that if that thing starts to let go, it could hold a tremendous amount of fire and spread that fire throughout the front of that building. And one of the assessment things that when I said you got to assess and forecast is how well involved is the underside of that fascia on arrival? How much is the fire is rolling out of the front of that occupancy and getting up in there? Because if it's anything at all, if you've done your homework and done your pre-plans and, you know, looked at your buildings and walked them and thought about it from a fire aspect, there's probably venting and everything else along that fascia to let air up in there. So it's a natural chimney for fire to go from the horizontal aspect to the vertical aspect. And I think far too many times people underestimate the fact that that's a hidden space and one that could carry a potential for a lot of fire, as well as some structural collapse early on if it's not dealt with. So it's got to be opened up the same as the roof, just as aggressively, if not a little bit more. Mm-hmm. And positive pressure in that aspect, you might as well just call it a wind tunnel, because you start throwing a fan up into there, getting a good air current working in that fascia, and you're just going to run that fire everywhere that fascia is. So it's going to be well past where you anticipate it is, even if it's not that way in the attic, it will be in the fascia.
Right.
So I think it's something that really has to be acknowledged from a forecasting standpoint of looking at where that fire is and where it's going to be, and if I do anything that's a little bit outside the recognized tactics for that type of a situation, I'm going to help that thing along.
Yep, absolutely. Jennifer brought up a good point earlier, and she started kind of breaking down the incident, and I want to go back to her and ask her. And not that there isn't any absolutes in fire ground command, but kind of walk us through Riverside City, outstanding organization, the command structure of a strip mall fire. And I'm just going to say we got 10 units, strip mall, 200 by 40, number five's on fire. Hey, why not? Sounds like a captain's exam. Number five's on fire, fully involved upon arrival. It's midday. Pretty much you got a bunch of people out in the parking lot. Walk me through the command. In other words, who's going to take fire attack? Who's going to take Delta 1, Bravo 1 exposure? Even if you're going to do that, are you going to make it Alpha Division? Are you going to make it Interior? Just kind of walk me through your basic first alarm.
Okay. Well, you know, as a first arriving company officer, I'm obviously going to be taking command until the next arriving officer comes in, which is usually our battalion chief. Now, he or she may opt to allow me to continue taking command depending on how large the incident is and if I can actually do something without having to go in with my firefighter. And if they leave me into command, then my main concern is, you know, number five is on fire, and I could go with the whole Riccio thing based on the time of day, making sure that our priorities are the victims or the people that are inside the structure, you know, getting them out, making sure that I'm painting a picture for those incoming units so that they know the extent of the fire and what's actually happening, so that they can, you know, gear up and be ready to do what tasks they need to do. But getting additional resources in, setting the standard of the Division A, which is the address side, and of course, you know, clockwise B, C, and D. I'm going to make sure I establish my water supply, make sure I've got a unit in there, probably multiple ones, because as you know, in a strip center, you know, we may be operating on hydrants that are just located in the parking lot. They're not the actual city water, so we need to be real careful about that. And making assignments and you know, having objectives, having a plan, and knowing that if that plan doesn't transpire by a certain trigger point, then I'm going to have an additional plan after that. As far as the command, it just depends if I'm taking it or if I'm passing it as to what my actions are going to be. But it's everything that you've learned in the ICS, you know, command classes as to setting up for not failure, but to win the situation. So
very good. And you bring up a couple of good points, and I want to highlight them as water supply. Water supply is huge. I think personally, and panel, correct me if I'm wrong. People in the audience here, you guys throw things at me if you think I'm wrong. I think a lot of our officers have forgotten the importance of water supply, and I recall, and I could be incorrect, but I recall that in Riverside City, you had to take the engineer's exam before you could take the captain's exam a while back, or maybe it's still in place.
Yes, that's correct.
And again, I've said this in previous podcasts. I believe that is a absolute necessity, that at a minimum you have passed an engineer's exam before you can promote to company officer, because you understand that water supply issue. The other thing is that I think a lot of our younger company officers and even our older company officers may not understand the fire flow that is going to be required for this. And they underestimate it. They come in with the residential fire mentality, and Jennifer brought it up earlier, is that we're going to big lines. We're going to big lines on this because we need the required fire flow to stop this thing from advancing. You also mentioned an outstanding point, which was, as we're approaching this, setting that command structure early and not getting task-oriented. And I want to go to Chris here on this, is how important is establishing the command structure early on a strip mall fire? When we see people, particularly on larger structures, going task-oriented on us and not remaining in the strategic process, the incident typically breaks down and we're behind the curve. So, Chris, what do you have to say about that?
I strongly agree with you. I think it's one of the number one priorities as soon as your initial lines are starting to be deployed and your water supply is being addressed on that first end is getting the cavalry coming. It's the age-old adage of front-loading because we're already behind. And establishing just some basic components of ICS to just kind of set up for success and organizing the events, you know, initiating command, establishing a staging area, and then plugging in the resources, you know, and supporting that truck in the rear with an engine. You know, and don't rely on that single 1 5-inch supply line because it's not, you know, we need to staff it appropriately. Bring in the safety officers, get the overhead there to support the troops that are actually going to be going tactical, you know, and using... you know, using that next in chief or another captain for a second opinion on, here's my initial plan. If it breaks past this, like you were talking about, you know, kind of where we're going to forecast it and establishing kind of a mental demarcation line of 2 units over here, or we're going to go to the big end over here, and then loading the resources appropriately and making sure there's adequate rehab.
Mm-hmm. You know, Jennifer brought up another point too, and it reminded me very well of identifying the alpha side of the structure. Not all of our strip malls are straight across, addressed off the street. Sometimes they're U-shaped, sometimes they're L-shaped. Sometimes there's a differing type of arrangement, as you will, of those. And identifying that alpha division, because as we start divisioning this off, and that's kind of where I want to go. I want to go talk to Wes about this. Divisioning this fire off quickly is going to be successful because we're bringing in the cavalry. Both Jennifer and Chris said so. We're bringing them in. We're striking a second. We're striking a third. We're staging resources. We're front-loading this incident. How important, Wes, is it for us to division this off and get good functional groups working within those divisions?
Well, I think it's one of those things that you just have to do. It's critical to do that. Because like you said, you're going to have resources coming in large volumes as soon as you start putting in more alarms into the process. And you need a place for them to go. This is a place where you could have a lot of freelancing. Mm-hmm. People see something. We're action-oriented. I'm going to do something. I have to. That's why they pay me. So you've got to get somebody there to manage them, especially if you're sending them to the roof. You're going to have multiple things going on in that roof. Just as an example, you're going to have multiple things going on in that roof at the same time, multiple groups working. You know, you may have people doing heat holes, people doing strip vents, simultaneously opening up the fascia.
So that has to be managed. Otherwise, there's no coordination between the groups that are working. Same thing with on the ground. You've got people going into the B exposures, B1, 2, 3. Same with the Delta exposures, D1, 2, 3. You've got to get good aggressive officers in those positions to be able to manage the resources that are coming in. And I think it's very important that you get ahead of that curve and not just check off the boxes, but actually you have to think about this as if, for lack of a better thing, it's a multi-story building laying on its side. You have to approach it almost in that respect, that you're divisioning it as you would if you were going up mm-hmm. in floors. It's just laying on its side.
Yeah, I've never heard it put that way, and that's great.
But, those are just some of the things I think about. The other thing I was thinking about was initial engine company on scene that Jennifer was talking about. We think we underestimate sometimes or don't think about, because we're so locked into residential tactics, we don't think about the fact that that engine company, if it has a water source, can knock a lot of heat out of that thing before an engine or anybody else shows up by using their deck gun. Mm-hmm. If it's a well-involved center occupancy, fire up that big GPM deck gun, and you can knock down a lot of fire while you're pulling your stretching your lines. Your engineer can operate that, or your firefighter can jump up there. But it's just, we often don't think about leading off with something like that. We always we pull a line. Well, 1¾-inch line won't put out what that deck gun's putting out, and it won't absorb the heat as fast, and it won't slow it down. And that's what we ultimately need to do. So I just wanted to touch on that before we got too far along here away from that particular part of the subject, just to think about that in addition. But
well, let me interrupt it right there for just a second, Wes, because I think the key there, because I've seen it go both ways. Mm-hmm. I've seen them come screaming in. They're laying line. It looked like Jed Clampett and the Beverly Hillbillies. And, sure enough, Captain says, fire up the wagon battery, and they're 15 feet away from the occupancy.
Right.
And all they're hitting is the sidewalk in front. And so my point there is that I believe spotting of that initial engine company is key. And one of the things that we have continually tried to teach our engineers is, provided you have the opportunity, mm-hmm. spot at a 45 with your rear bumper facing mm-hmm. the occupancy. Because what does that do? Jennifer brought it up earlier. We're going big lines. Where are your big lines? You're going to build them off the rear of your apparatus, by and large. And I understand some people run some 2.5-inch bundled crosslays. But the point being is, if you come in and position your apparatus at a 45 with the tail facing the alpha division, and you are far enough away from that exposure, that allows you the opportunity to utilize the wagon battery. Mm-hmm. And it also allows you to build your lines from the rear of the structure. And the other thing it does, a lot of people don't realize, is that recognizing we're going to be utilizing a lot of water here, is it positions the eye of the pump in a manner that it's more functional to lay away. Mm-hmm. So I get engine 3 coming in, and I say, engine 3, I want you guys to lay away, position yourself on the hydrant and support the hydrant mm-hmm. operation. And I think, maybe I'm wrong, but I think when you say that to some of the newer battalion chiefs, the newer company officers, the newer engineers, they get, slot machines and crickets, because they've never even trained on putting a pumper on the hydrant. And they don't understand that that's why we have fire marshals out there that make them steamer connections mm-hmm. and not just single ports. So,
and I think it gets back to doing your homework. I've said several times that we are the fire department, therefore we should be really good at fighting fire. And unfortunately, we get caught up in so much other minutia that we lack oftentimes in our skills for actually fighting fire. So this comes down to doing your homework and thinking like a firefighter of what happens when this building is on fire, where do we park, what are our potentials, all of the things you discussed. That's all that where training becomes real important. And unfortunately, that's relative to the skill level and experience level of the person that's doing the training mm-hmm. and how they think of that, because they may not have a good grasp on certain things. But spotting's a big deal, and that comes back to the company officer have been an engineer. Mm-hmm. All those things are important in incidents like this, which were not necessarily frequent, but have the potential to grow very quickly into, you know, defensive fires where the engine becomes an exposure because it's not parked in a correct spot.
Right, and I could see, you know, I could see a heads up engineer telling the company officer, hey, we got, you know, we got a water supply in the parking lot. You know, it's a 4 and a 2.5. It's a single port. I'll take that initially, but you know, I want you to have somebody lay away and grab that steamer on the corner. You know, and I mean, you know, what an ideal situation, because then we can also feed, you know, God forbid we lose this thing, we can feed the ladder pipes off that as well, and support our ladder pipe operations. You touch on something there, Wes, and it's a little off chart from the strip malls, but I think it's important, is those that are providing the training with the experience opened up to the group. How many times in your organization, and Chris, you're in this position now, fortunately you've got experience, how many times have you seen, maybe not in your organization but in other organizations, where the junior captain goes into training for 2 years because nobody else wants that job, as opposed to the senior, more experienced people going into training, the ones with the wisdom, the knowledge, and that? I'll just start off. I've seen it nationwide, where your first assignment as a company officer is training, because you're enthusiastic. That's always the excuse. Anybody else?
Seen it?
I believe it happens all over the place.
How about in Riverside City? I don't think you guys do that.
Well, as far as the way I see training, I mean, yes, you can put experienced people in there, but that's if, I mean, experienced, you have to define that word. Mm-hmm. Is it someone who's been at a slow station but been on 20 years, or is it somebody who's been at the big house that, you know, has been on maybe half the time but has had a lot of fires under their belt or experiences that they can share with the people that they're training? You know, you hit on the fact that motivation's key. Well, you definitely need somebody who's motivated, who wants to teach, who's inspired by going out and coming to these seminars and you know, teaching and you know, networking and what have you, because that's part of getting out information, you know, to your troops, is by, you know, you sharing things with me. If I don't get out there and learn what's new and what's going on and new methods and things of that nature, then, you know, I can't bring back fresh ideas to my department. So I think, you know, you have to have a happy medium. You have to have that experience, but you also do have to have someone who's motivated, excited to be there, and wants to take it, you know, an extra step of the way.
You hit the nail on the head. It's, you know, 1 year repeated 30, 1 year repeated 30 times is an experience. You know, you can have a 30-year experienced firefighter in 10 years, you know, as if that person has been working at the busy companies and doing that self-directed learning to make themselves better and sharing. That's the beauty to come into these conferences is the sharing. I ran into Bill Clayton, been on the job well over 40 plus years, worked for Cal Fire, probably the foremost expert in wildland in the nation, and he's still here sharing. After all that time, Chief Brunicini still here sharing, his sons. So that's the key word, is that we need to share, because we need to get this knowledge out. Let me ask, we want to talk a little bit, go back to some truck stuff, because I think truck stuff is cool. Roof division ventilation group. Now, I know that oftentimes you will hear ICs say, you know, truck one, you're going to be ventilation group, and they go to the roof. And, you know, and I'm okay with that. I mean, that if that's the way you want to do it. But this is where I see that getting messed up. And the reason I see it getting messed up, and why my personal preference, and this is just my personal preference, but it also follows ICS, is that those that are going to the roof are roof division. It is a geographical location. Those that are operating at ground level are ventilation group, therefore allowing them to work through multiple divisions. Comments? besides just yes? Come on, let's talk about this.
I think on particularly the the one or two story residentials, or even maybe a three story, you're a taxpayer. You know, split company operations. I know this isn't the place to talk about it, but putting someone on the roof and identifying them geographically as roof division, and that's my engineer. And then I'm down on the first floor, or I'm down on the outside doing the exterior, or I'm starting to work inside, and I'm assuming the vent group. I think ICS has done us a lot of good. At the same time, it's kind of tied us hand with the definition. I mean, by geographical location or by, the task, or it gets a group name. On the strip mall situation and staffing that event properly, like the example you provided with the 10-unit and a fire in the middle, that's a lot of work, and there needs to be one single point of contact with the flow through the chain, that can communicate all the information we're gathering and requesting resources, and there's a single point. As far as down on the ground on the strip mall and establishing a vent group, I think it still has its application. It's just, is the organization trained up to who's who in the zoo as far as roof divisions running the whole ventilation, or is it the vent group that's now running the whole ventilation and coordinating with whoever it may be as a roof division?
Well, and that's a great point, Chris, because, in my mind, it's real simple. I'm either talking to roof division or I'm talking to vent group. And the beauty, and Jennifer, I want to ask you, because, you've been around, is that the beauty is that when you talked about recognizing the potential hazards that exist on these strip malls, the structural elements that we're dealing with the potential of collapse, that's a critical fire ground factor, okay? The potential of collapse is a potential fire ground setback. Not a hazard, it's a setback. And therefore, if ventilation group is operating under the facade for a period of time, providing positive pressure ventilation, maybe opening doors, maybe it's even a forcible entry group, but it's a group that's going to be working across those divisions, Alpha, Delta, Bravo. I like to keep them as a group because as they go from division to division, who are they checking in with? That particular division. So let's just say, for sake of argument, vent group. I say ventilation group, I need ventilation in the Bravo division. They say, okay. And I say, once you complete that, check back with me and I'll reassign you. Well, when they go to Bravo division, they're checking in with Bravo division. That's an accountability for me. So if we have a structural collapse in that area, I know, A, Bravo division knows who's all there and who's working there. And secondarily, I know as well. That's why I like me particularly as an IC. Jennifer, what's your thoughts on that?
I think the size of the incident plays a big role. And my huge thing is accountability. I'm agreeance with you as far as having a roof division. You're talking about the incident's large. You're going to be there for a while. And having somebody in charge of multiple truck companies or a truck and a couple engines, whoever's on that roof, that's what I like, because I want, as operations, I want to be able to report back to one individual who, with the span of control, and have that individual, give me an update as to just the roof. As far as the ventilation group, I'm the same. Keep it simple. If you have somebody that's going to be doing horizontal ventilation, or you have a division and they want a specific unit to be assigned to ventilating, down below, then that's fine to have that type of a group. But I think as long as everybody on the scene knows, or your department knows, that when you're called the roof division, that means you're assigned to that truck captain for that specific operation or for that area.
Right, right. And I know Wes, Wes Santa Rosa, some good fire activity over the years. And with that fire activity, how many times did you see the effectiveness of calling additional overhead to these incidents based upon the size that Jennifer's talking about to run those divisions? And how did that work in allowing company officers to get freed up?
Oh, it worked well. That's what chiefs do. For lack of a better,
I've been wondering what they do.
But that allows the people to get back into with their companies
keep some company cohesion, give some good directions. On the roof, I'm not so sure that's a good place for a chief, and let me qualify why I say that.
I'm getting heartburn now.
I know you are. It's okay. Okay. I think for the roof division, you've got to have someone up there that's used to doing that work.
Yeah.
And if the chief officer was a trucker before in a previous life, that's one thing. If it was more engine company operations, then, you know, if they're really paying attention to their fire ground stuff, then they're going to understand how long it takes to open roofs. Mm-hmm. Look at the whole issue of bottle or air management if you're up there in a smoky environment, how long it takes to do the work, on and on and on, because they're going to have to forecast crew rotations so that it's seamless. We're not, you know, abandoning something to get another crew up there and there's that downtime or lost time interval between calling for the people and getting them up there and having them have to pick up where the other crew left off. Now the fire's changed. What's going on? So it's important that in certain places there are people that are very familiar with that type of work that's being done. I think that's an important thing. And it may not be that a chief on the roof makes that seamless fit. It may be that it is the truck officer that's up there operating and getting that forecasting back to the incident commander. You know, this is going to take a long time. I need four more companies ready to go in the back of the building where our ladders are placed so that we can get them up here, you know, rather than having sit in stage.
Let me, and you kind of triggered something. Let me ask the group, how far off base would a incident commander be? If let's go back to our fire. We've got a well-involved unit, 10-unit occupancy, well-involved unit number 5, heavily charged units in the Bravo 1, Delta 1 exposure. And let's just say, for sake of argument, you hear an incident commander call a third alarm, strike a third alarm on that. And you're thinking, and I'm thinking, you got to be kidding me. You know, what is this guy thinking? That is a whole lot of iron rolling down the road. And when you ask, if you had an opportunity to stop the fire and walk up and ask him what was he thinking, and he said, "I need a chief and 3 RIC companies on this fire, and I want to put a RIC to the back. I want to put a RIC on the Bravo and a RIC on the Delta Division, and I want a chief at the buggy as my rapid intervention group leader." How far off base would that guy be?
I think it's appropriate.
Think it's
to start.
Appropriate off based upon the picture we painted.
Yeah, and all the lessons learned to this date. You know, we have to have that little special ops group in position.
I agree. I don't think that's far off base at all.
Could and in my opinion, and I'm going to pitch it to Jennifer here, is I could see the RIC company to the rear, Charlie Division, actually actively working, softening the structure, opening up the rear of the structure, taking some irons and rotary saws, getting that rear structure opened up, ticking, doing an external exposure control through thermal imaging camera work, maybe even capturing the rear utilities, you know, being a functional, proactive RIC, definitely throwing a working set. And we're going to go to a working set here. Jennifer, thoughts on that?
Well, my first thought is, you know, every department, depending on their size, depending on their staffing, is going to dictate just how many people you can get to an incident right away, or whether you're waiting on, you know, mutual aid or what have you. If you have the resources and you have the personnel, you know, by all means, if that IC, who's probably had a lot of experience and knows what they're talking about, if they want to call for 3 RIC teams and a BC in charge of the RIC team, or is the RIC team leader, you know, by all means, it's just safety for ourselves on the incident. You know, the other thought on that is, you know, every RIC team isn't going to be, well, hopefully isn't going to be activated. So there are things that they can be doing to be proactive in the incident without, leaving their spot as a RIC team. Mm-hmm. You know, they can shut off utilities, they can throw ladders, they can do little things as long as they're back in their designated area. But with the BC being accountable for them. You know, if you have an extra officer, chief officer that can do that, then great, because there's one person that they have to report to. If they can't, if you don't have any extra chief officers for that, if you have a three-person crew, four-person crew, that captain can very well be a RIC team leader, still having the two-in, two-out rule followed.
Yeah, I think the hardest part that we find, you know, is that the incident commander, and we've seen it on various fires, we look at some of the close call type incidents, and that is that that incident commander still trying to maintain the firefight operation and run it as an incident commander, no matter how well he's divisioned it off. Once that mayday goes out, or once that structural collapse occurs, or once that firefighter goes down, that RIC activation becomes that incident within an incident. And the complexity of the size of the structure, and I'm going to go to Chris and Jennifer on this. In Salinas and in Riverside City, there are commercial Type 3 occupancies, tilt-ups, that are well over 100, 200, 300,000 square feet. And just the mere size and complexity of that creates an issue where you may have to have multiple teams operating some distance from one another. Mm-hmm. And with that, having that oversight is going to be key. So how do you guys address it in your communities with getting overhead? What's a typical overhead response to a large commercial structure?
Well, I can think of one, you know, that I've been on that was probably 100,000 square feet building, and we had active firefighting operations going on. They had established a RIC crew with a RIC team leader that was placed at whether it was A side, B side, they were at one specific location, and that's all we had. But in my mind, assigned to the RIC team, what I was thinking was we should have multiple ones at the different areas. Just because of the size of the building. I mean, our equipment that we have, our ropes, you know, they're only 200 feet, maybe 300 if it's off of a rescue or a truck. So we need to have that mobility and have those people placed at those various locations, because we don't know that we're just going to have an incident on that A side where they're staged. So, you know, as far as getting any extra overhead, it's going to be tough for us. We may get Riverside County units and what have you, but they're probably going to be assigned to other operations. Mm-hmm. And as far as the chiefs go, they're going to be doing the whole, you know, safety officer, liaison, PIO. If it's big enough, you know, they're going to be filling those positions.
So. Yeah, they're going to make Camp Snoopy director before they send a chief to run a division. And maybe that's my own personal pitch, is that as chief officers, we have to start understanding that our company officers and our initial ICs need additional overhead. And more importantly is that when we arrive, to do what's right, not to try and micromanage the incident, or that DAX will become a functional part. But that's, you know, that's another podcast, and Pete Matthews will decide if we do that one or not. So we're going to bring it home here, and we're going to start off with Wes and go to Wes, and let's just for the podcast people listening to that, let's just run through a typical strip mall first alarm operation. Jennifer had kind of an opportunity to do it, but let's give it some nuts and bolts. Wes, I've got a 10-unit complex, 10-unit occupancy. Number 5's heavily involved upon arrival. You've got units in the Bravo 1, Delta 1 charged, and it appears as though you have some extension into the fascia. What would Santa Rosa have sent, and how would those units have laid out?
If we had that scenario, it would be the standard response would be 3-in-1 and a chief, 3 engines and a truck and a chief. Obviously, if it's well involved, we would up it to a work and fire assignment, which is 4-in-1 and 2 chiefs, and then it would probably be 2 alarms additional on top of it, so a total of 3 alarms. And the reason for that is you've got multiple things going on in this building. And looking at the three
top priorities in the fire ground, the you know, life safety, incident stabilization, property conservation kind of a thing. You're going to start eating people, both in setting up the divisions of work, where the first end engine gets a good water supply, spotting correctly, thinking about going larger, getting the truck up on the roof, starting to set up a division, starting to think about offensive heat holes, defensive strips, open up the fascia, you know, real aggressive, get ahead of it. But if it's a center unit, you've got to do that in two directions. You can't just do it in one. So those additional bodies are going to be real critical. You're going to start eating companies. And then not even getting into the rotation, just initially, you've got possibly four companies up there working, three for sure, probably four, if it's any heavy kind of roof or any heavy fire involvement up there. Then you've got your fire attack in the involved. If nothing else, that's a write-off. We're going to the sides because they're charged. That's going to be an issue. You've got primary attack lines, backup lines. You've got to think about salvage, ventilation for, and you know, backing up the vertical ventilation, softening the structure in the back. Three alarms is probably a minimum in my particular mind on incidents that I have actually commanded as a acting chief. You'll use that many units trying to make that happen, and then just rotating crews, not saying, okay, single bottle use, now let's go out and drink a gallon of water. But you're going to sooner or later reach a point of fatigue where you're going to have to rotate some people around. So I think you need to be really thinking with a well-involved middle unit, common attic. First officer shows up and says, we've got smoke charged in each of the side, Bravo 1 and Delta 1 units. You've got to be thinking this thing can go south really quick and start really taking on some accelerated fire behavior. Mm-hmm. So I think that's pretty much how it would lay out in my particular department. Rick would be down the line a little bit.
Okay.
Because we got to put people to work to get this fire put out. Then we're going to put Rick into service.
Very good. Very good. And I want to ask you a real quick question, because it seems like maybe let's say 20 years ago, the thought philosophy was that we were always going to fight the fire from the rear of the structure because we were afraid of the collapse of the facade. And we're going to go through that Charlie division, that heavily secured, heavily barred 36-inch man door, and blow it out the front. Successful?
Well, if all things are right, sure. But that assumption is the fact that it's a straight through from the back to the front, and there's no breakups, no partitions, no nothing. I mean, if that's the case, you know, and because you've checked the building, you know that if you open the door, you look straight through. That's one thing. If it's like every other building that's got storage in the back and, you know, the business part in the front, that's not necessarily a good thing. You may have to attack from the front if that's where you're.
Yeah, I kind of threw you a softball on that one.
That's all right.
I kind of agree. I think your primary is going to always be off the door that gets locked with a key.
Right.
Not the door that gets locked with a deadbolt and a padlock and a hockey puck and a bar and everything else.
Well,
so.
But you bring up a good point. If you think for even a second that you might be attacking from the back of the building, that's an immediate fire ground setback.
Mm-hmm.
Because it is going to take you a while to get through the layers of forcible entry on that building.
And there's some hazards associated with that, because that's typically where the overhead power lines are
absolutely
coming in.
Absolutely. The back of the building has advantages and disadvantages. And that's why I say you got to do your homework on these buildings. You can't just wait till they burn.
And the other thing, too, is people got to think about, and you know this being on the roof, is those HVAC units.
Mm-hmm.
Those HVAC units.
Well, you brought that up. Let me just touch real quick. I know we got to bring this home, but you touched on that when you were talking about the different types of roof construction and the like. The roof division is the eyes of the interior.
Mm-hmm.
And if you've got HVAC systems, you need to make that clear to the incident commander and the people inside.
Yep.
So that they don't have those things starting down on them.
Yeah. Lost a couple of heroes in Houston as a result of that. Chris, Salinas. You guys are up there, you're rolling, you guys are fighting a lot of fire today, in today's times. Walk me through your strip mall process.
Well, Chief, before I can, I guess, use your example here, which end is the gun store and which one's the Starbucks? Because I got to pick one end to save with the middle unit.
We'll say that the pet store with the puppies are on the Bravo, and Starbucks is on the Delta.
Okay. Well, our standard initial response is four engines, the truck, and the chief. Our guidelines within the county regarding this type of operation is the first arriving chief can make the determination how many more overheads. So can the first arriving officer. So I'm gonna try and surround this building in a strategic manner with engines. First two are gonna pull up in the front, secure the water supplies. Our alarms are pretty quick as far as their arrival. I'm gonna give the best spot to the truck that they feel that they need to spot defensively, but go into an aggressive mode. And then I'm gonna order in a strike our second alarm, which will clear out the rest of the city. I'm going to order a strike team of Type 1 engines, and I'm going to pull the rest of the ladders in on this one. And I should be able to staff that example, that strip mall, within about 25 minutes. The trucks are going to take a little bit longer, but then I'm going to strategically place the trucks on, let's say, where was the pet store in Starbucks? So I'll place them two on the big end and one about mid-span there.
Mm-hmm.
And try and augment those with resources for their ventilation needs, and if it ends up going defensive, we raise the sticks and start squirting.
Very good, very good. Yeah, I think always calling out the big end, calling out, as Gary Finney used to say, the most lost side. That's the side that becomes the primary exposure occupancy, and whether it's the Delta or the Bravo. And a lot of that might have to do with what's read on the signs. You know, you got a pool, Leslie's pool supply on your Delta 2. I'll tell you what, I want to get units into Delta 1 ASAP, because the last thing I want is a hazmat as in relation to that. We joke about it, but you know what? Nobody wants to lose a pet store. But then again, you know, Starbucks is very important as well. So, all right. Well, once again, this is Firehouse Podcast Live coming to you from Firehouse World 2010 in San Diego. I'd like to thank from Riverside City, Captain Jennifer McDowell. Thank you, Jennifer, for stepping in and helping us out. We appreciate it. It's great to see you, and we look forward to talking to you soon. Out of Salinas, Chris Vaughn, Captain and Training Officer Extraordinaire. Chris, we appreciate you being here and helping us out. Good luck in your travels as a training officer. We know that you're going to do good things.
Thanks, Chief.
Once again, welcome back, Wes Kitchell from Santa Rosa Fire Department, now retired, traveling around the world, working for Firetown, training specialist, among some of the other things. Wes is doing a lot of good things. You see him out there on the road. Say hi. From Firehouse World, this is Ed Hadfield. We'd like to bring it to an end. Thank you very much, and we'll see you on the big one.
If you have a comment on this program, drop us a line at radio@firehouse.com. Thanks for listening, and stay tuned to firehouse.com for more broadcasts like these. Or visit our website at www.firehouse.com/radio.